Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to AI Named This Show. I'm Tasia Custodi.
And with much more sleep this time around, I'm Tristan Jutra.
What fun is that, Tristan? We are your human hosts, and on this week's episode, Adobe is making more AI moves. We're spending the morning with the Rabbit R1, plus lots of news from Meta, Google, Apple, and more. And hello, or should I say, hey, to our listeners in Finland. And we just want to say, real quick, both Tristan and I believe we have said hey to you all before in Finland. In fact, we know we talked about Saku Koivu and a lot of other Finns we love. And yet, we cannot find proof that we did this. So let us know if we're hallucinating that or if we've already said hi to you.
Actually, do us all a favor, every one of you that's listening, go back and re-listen to all our episodes.
Scrub
we swear
through
this
them
is
all.
This is not a scam to get more advertising revenue. This is simply for public service, for the benefit of all, and especially the Finns.
There you
including
go.
Including Jarkko Ruutu. Finnish hockey fans at the Olympics were amazing back in 2010. That's all I got to say. See, that's why I think we had this conversation before. We really need AI to keep us on the ball, Tasia.
We're but having Adobe, a major case of deja vu.
Well, maybe Adobe can help us with that or with some other stuff anyway.
Yep. Let's kick things off here, Tristan, because Adobe is expanding their generative AI to video in Premiere Pro. I'm freaking out. This is very cool. So this upcoming update is going to allow users to add frames and make clips longer using generative AI. And they're also going to be able to remove objects in the background of a shot. So in a blog post announcing the launch, they said, quote, "The Premiere Pro team has been deeply engaged with the professional video community over the past year to understand how generative AI can solve real problems in their work." So I just want to do a real quick kind of surface dive for you, Tristan, on some of these cool features and how they'll work. The generative extend feature is going to allow video editors to add frames and make clips longer using AI to basically fill in the gaps. And it works by clicking and dragging to extend a clip to just the exact right length that you want to add a transition, adding J and L cuts and fine tuning pacing. So basically, like a J cut is when you hear the audio before the visual scene changes, and an L cut is the opposite. The scene would change first, you still have the same audio underneath before that changes. So this is kind of really cool to be able to fine tune that kind of thing, and obviously is going to be very useful for gaps in audio. So it means like basically any editor can extend like silent audio clips to create like ambient noise or a little ambiance if they want. They could smooth out any kind of jagged audio cuts. It's really, really cool. And then you can also add objects generated by AI, created by text prompts, Tristan. It's wild. So this allows editors to change landscapes, think backgrounds. You could swap out props and objects entirely. So this is getting like next level right now, okay?
We'll fix it in post.
We'll fix it in post to the next level, because here's the one that I think is the coolest in terms of this is that you can remove unwanted objects. So say there's a boom mic in your shot, or something I always think about is like there's a logo or a brand or something you can't show and shoot, it made the shot and you really want to use that clip. It can now be removed, Tristan.
Or an unwanted co-host, per se.
Oh, hey. Is that directed towards me, Tristan? It's just me talking to me, another version of me on this podcast.
It's what everyone always wanted. Okay, Tasia, these sound really cool. And obviously, this is kind of like an extension of what they've been doing with Firefly, with static images in Photoshop. Now, from what I understand, you've been a loyal Final Cut Pro user on the Apple mm-hmm. side of things. Is this enough to make you a little curious and to maybe dip back into the world of Adobe Premiere Pro? Or are you just going to like hold tight until Apple finally catches up?
No, this is huge. It's huge. And when this news broke, that was my first thought was, am I switching? Because, and then the second thought was, how fast can Apple do something similar? Because it's honestly kind of, if it works as well as they show some examples. And of course, as we always say with any of this stuff, is it's just going to get better and better. So I'm just can picture like the million reasons in my mind why you would use that and how to really take any of your video production to the next level. It's huge. So I'm kind of like, oh man, Apple, with your updates that you claim you're, you know, they like to talk about AI all the time now. It's like, please, please bring something like this to Final Cut, which I totally see, by the way, Tristan, because Final Cut's all about like dragging, dropping. Like it's so simplified. So when I hear mm-hmm. terms like that, like when they're like, oh, in Adobe, now you can just drag the clip. I'm like, this would make so much sense for Final Cut Pro.
We'll see. We'll see in June, maybe. But they got to walk before they can run. You know, they're still playing catch up. We'll talk about Apple a little later. But Adobe's not done, Tasia.
No, that is not all of the Adobe goodness yet. One more quick bit of follow-up news for you is that you can now use Adobe's new upscaling tech to sharpen video. Apologies if you hear Poppy in the background, as per usual.
And the name?
Oh, yeah. It's Video Gigagan. Video Gigagan, all one word. GAN is caps lock. It stands for General Adversarial Networks. Guys, we don't need to get into the whole thing.
Yeah. But Video Gigagan.
Yeah, Video Gigagan. Say that three times fast. It's an experimental AI feature that can enhance sharpness up to 8 times with fewer artifacts than before. So basically less pixelated and junky looking than before. According to Adobe, it avoids the usual artifacts and flickering introduced by GAN. At the same time, it's adding sharpness and detail. So where most other systems fail to do both of those things at once. So that's like the big thing here. So you know how before we talked about like Zoom Enhance? This is like a million episodes ago now. I don't want people to confuse it. This is not that. Like, you're not going to have like a CSI moment of Zoom Enhance here, because it's what it's doing is it's literally making up detail that does not exist. So this isn't going to like enhance on a situation. It's filling in the blanks, essentially, of what it should look like and making it look cleaner, if you will. So you can imagine if something like this is added to Premiere Pro or After Effects, I mean, holy moly, it can allow video producers to make really almost any low resolution shots look a heck of a lot better. So it is really limited right now. Like, I think it's really short clips that are only something like maybe 12 or 17 frames per second. Like, it's not, they're not doing it on faces and people right now. Like, you know, this is going to be, as you say, walk before you run. So we'll see where this goes. But it does remind me of, like, you know, because there are tools where you can sharpen video. There's an easy one in Final Cut Pro that I have used. So, you know, it's like this, but to the next level, basically, which is very exciting. And again, the examples they show looked really awesome, but they are just very short clips. So we'll see how quickly they move on this one as well. But if this is a sign of what's to come for Adobe, holy moly.
Well, it's pretty exciting that all these tools, practical tools for people to help get their jobs done more quickly and efficiently. It's not just about the day-to-day generative models that we think about, like ChatGPT and Gemini and the like, for writing stuff. It's all these generative art tools, now video tools, and it's not all about stealing people's artwork and stuff like that. It's actually productivity enhancers. So great to see these real-world applications becoming more and more refined. Some other follow-up news we have. We spoke last week about the Rabbit R1 Live. It's an impending release, and it finally launched, and they had a event. They described it initially as an unboxing event, but it was actually like a live pickup event in New York City for folks who had ordered the first 300 of the Rabbit R1 devices. And the event went on for the better part of an hour and was basically an extended demo of a number of the features. And it sort of continues with their style, their kind of informal style and commitment to real world demonstrations of features. And it seems that the folks at Humane maybe picked up a little bit on that style, because some of their later videos were a bit more loose and casual as well. In this pickup party live event, they made some unnamed but pretty obvious digs at the Humane AI pin, which was kind of interesting to see. But now what's happened is that people have gotten their hands on them. They didn't have review units for any of the journalists out there. People had to buy them themselves. And, you know, at $200 a pop, some folks were happy to do that. But we're seeing some common themes, and sort of like with the Human AI pin, it's maybe the Rabbit R1 maybe isn't quite what it's cracked up to be, especially in the sense that there was features that people were expecting that aren't there on launch day. So we went through a number of the reviews. Mine is probably still a couple of months away. We'll see. I can't wait to actually get my own hands on it, if I haven't been totally disillusioned by the nature of the reviews to date. But just a quick refresher, the R1 is an AI-powered gadget designed by Teenage Engineering. Well, the case is designed by Teenage Engineering, and it was a big highlight at CES. You know, people described it as fun and whimsical with the distinctive electric orange glossy case that you may recall. So it really pops out. Teenage Engineering had also designed the Playdate, which with the Crank, the sort of little retro gaming device, and they've done all sorts of music devices over the last several years as well. Sort of a legendary design house, so that collaborated with Rabbit on this one. So it's 115 grams, fairly wide with flat edges, so which some reviewers described as not being the most comfortable to hold, but it has strategically placed buttons which make for easy navigation, like the smooth scrolling wheel. But again, some people felt that the scroll wheel took too many rolls or to select desired options. One of the other things that I noticed from the demo is that it seemed like old school scrolling, kind of like how we used to scroll on mice before Apple flipped things around, so that the scrolling was more like we do with our phones and tablets, where you're scrolling the content as opposed to scrolling the scroll bar. And just from the demo that I saw, it seemed like it was kind of the old style way. So hopefully there's an option in there, because my brain is programmed to scroll everything the same way, whether it's on my trackpad, on my computer, or on my iPhone or iPad. So that's another, just like a little niggle there, but hopefully they'll have options for changing that. One of the other things that was new to me, that if you turn the device sideways so the scroll wheel's at the bottom, you can also call up an on-screen keyboard. So it's just wide enough, and it seems to work okay. Again, hands-on use. I think we'll probably get to more more details on how effective it actually is. But apparently that's the only touchscreen capability currently for that screen, is just the on-screen keyboard. You can't really use it for any other navigation. The rest of it is with the scroll wheel, which you can select and click with. People commented on the design, including the bouncing rabbit icon, the bright color, which kind of evoking nostalgia for 90s pocket toys like the Tamagotchi, for example. So it's sort of like my little sister's generation.
The Nano Baby.
The hardware has been compared to like an average Android phone. It's got a 2.88-inch screen, a MediaTek MT6765 processor, if that means anything to you. Just 128 gigs of storage and just 4 gigabytes of RAM. And it's got a got an 8 megapixel camera, which is sort of uniquely positioned to spin and face both directions. It includes features like Rabbit Eye for camera-based functions and a vision feature for image analysis. So it can see and describe things, that you see in the world. Kind of like the Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses, which we'll just talk about in a little bit. The basic AI capabilities it offers currently, like playing music, although I've heard mixed reviews on how well it actually plays music for you on command, answering questions and ordering services like Uber. They did a live demo of ordering an Uber and then they had to cancel it right away. They ordered some McDonald's food and got it going. So there's also been some talk about how it actually does this. We've heard about the large action model, they call it. And there was a bit of a leak a couple of days ago of supposedly some code that revealed how they were making some of this work. And apparently they're using virtualized machines in the cloud. So they've got, service base, they've got, however many CPUs they're renting in the cloud, and they've got virtual PCs running, basically one for each device, I would imagine, that stores the credentials when you're logging in. They're not using APIs for these services. They're basically running virtual PCs in the cloud to store, to save and hash your credentials so that it can make it work with all your services back down to your device. So that's kind of interesting take there. They kept talking about how fast it all was, and maybe that's why. Maybe it's faster than using the native APIs. I mean, that seems a little strange to me. But, again, the proof is going to be in the pudding. People have only had it in their hands for like a day. So two tops so far. So we'll see more in-depth reviews as time goes on. However, a lot of the people who have been testing it out so far have been encountering a number of limitations, such as the inability to send emails or to make spreadsheets. So these were all things that he actually demoed, the CEO actually demoed, is Jesse Liu. So those are kind of missing in action. The device actually lacks any web browsing capabilities as well. So it connects via 4G LTE, which they mentioned in the demo, and Wi-Fi, but it can't be used to make calls or send text messages. So you can put a SIM card in it, but apparently you can't call anyone or send text messages with it. So again, that's the kind of thing you would do with your phone anyway. And we've talked about how do we need another device in our lives? And that's the challenge with something like this. Battery life described as satisfactory, and the device does not come with a charging cable. It does, however, come with a little protective case, which you can set it up and view it as, and you can access all the screen and controls when it's in the case, but no charging cable. They've made a number of ambitious promises for its future capabilities with forthcoming features like an alarm, not shipping built in, calendar, and GPS support. So there's some things that like the Humane AI pin were missing. People are like, huh? And guess what? The Rabbit R1 are also missing too. Again, so much of it is like get your MVP, your minimum viable product out the door. So I get that. And luckily with devices like this, they can keep updating the software as time goes on. Now, here's the thing. Instead of $700 and $24 a month, like the Humane AI pin, this is only $200. So for a lot of people, that's like the price under which you're kind of okay to just go and buy it without checking with your spouse. Like people have done, they've done studies on stuff like this. So
yeah, because it doesn't do anything. Like it'll answer a couple questions and it might order your food for you. But right now that's about it, folks. So you can do that from the device you already have.
But just the funny thing is aware. And so listening to some of the reviews on, and reading the, one of the common refrains was, well, at least it's cheap. Like people seem to feel a bit better about that than the Humane AI pin.
Because you're holding like a plastic square in your hand. Like, let's just call it what it is. Like, I love this whole on-screen keyboard and everybody's so pumped about it. Like, what is happening? We already have this device.
It's called a smartphone.
Way more capable. Oh my God.
So your deserved skepticism aside, Tejan, and we all should be skeptical, but you know, it's also exciting to see new small companies trying things. They've sold over 100,000 units this quarter, and they aim to continue adding value with new upcoming features, etc. So the approach is tailored to tinkerers and enthusiasts, and they're trying to offer a device with personality and character. I mean, again, kind of like what we saw with Teenage Engineering's also other collaboration with the Playdate. People could argue, like, what do we need the Playdate for? We've already got the Steam Deck and the, you know, there was the PS Vita and now the whatever the PlayStation replacement was for that. And, you know, we've got the Nintendo Switch. Why do we need another gaming device that seems even less capable? Well, there are people who like to tinker, and maybe they will open things up so you can tinker even more. And I think people naturally like to root for the little guy. We've seen so much homogeneity from the big players for so long, Apple and Google, and people are like just crying out for something a little bit different. And, you know, this is Orange, if nothing else, and a unique form factor and interface. So I have to reserve judgment until I actually get my hands on one, but I'm still curious and intrigued. And again, this is just the beginning. People blasted the iPod when it first came out, the iPhone when it first came out, also the first Palm Pilot. There's all sorts of things that were, you know, kind of...
Well, two of those things don't exist anymore, so...
Well, some of those things evolved into other things, and some maybe they'll get bought up. Who knows? But anyway, so that's just a little recap on the hardware side of things. But there's just a little bit more hardware news in a similar space, Tasia.
Yeah, so... The Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses finally have multimodal AI. So when we say multimodal, basically what we're saying is the ability for an AI assistant to process multiple types of information. So you could think like photos, audio, text, and the like. So this, by the way, what timing this is, because of course, like Rabbit R1, we just had the launch and the flop of the Humane AI bin. I had to say the launch and flop, sorry. Oh. But the primary function of the Meta smart glasses really is to prompt them by saying, like you say, hey, Meta, and then fill in the blank. So you could say something like, tell me what kind of car this is, or read this sign in whatever language and things like that. So the glasses take a picture, the AI communicates with the cloud, and then an answer is given to you in your ears. So there's a really good initial review of these new capabilities and also limitations on The Verge, which we will link to that in the show notes. In general, the review pretty much found that the glasses act as like a natural extension of what you would do with your phone. So instead of having to take your phone out and take a bit more time, maybe fumbling with your thumbs to do a text inquiry, you could just ask your smart glasses and get usually a correct result, but
usually maybe sometimes.
Exactly. And they talk about that in the article as well, like some of the limitations, one being the lack of zoom. So if you're trying to identify an animal or a plant or something that's maybe further away, it may not be accurate because it's not able to really zoom in on that and get a good...
Can I eat this mushroom?
Yeah, right. Definitely do not use it for anything life or death.
Life-threatening.
Exactly. But I mean, it's an exciting advancement for them, and I think just in the nick of time, and it's obviously needed because you have to, like we're saying, like with all these devices, like it can't just do the one thing. Like you have to be able to prompt it in different ways, and then hopefully it'll get more accurate as it learns.
Well, it's nice to see the little guys like Meta get a win once in a while.
You know, just they really need it.
I think this is the form factor that is going to have the best chance of succeeding when it comes to the AI devices. I've been saying it for a while. I would love to have... I came this close to getting the first generation, but there was just too limited and it didn't have the AI assistant features. And that's something that they added partway through the second generation. That's the cool part of with these devices. They can keep enhancing the capabilities. Version 3 is going to be even better. So I'm kind of on the fence now. It's been about half a year since these second generation ones have come out, and they've, with these multimodal features that they've added, they've also introduced a new style, a third style in the Ray-Ban line. So you can get your traditional Wayfarer's style and then two other styles of, and then you can get them, of course, with sunglass lenses or regular prescription lenses or transitions.
You can do transition, which that's what you have to do, I think, because if you want to be wearing them, I don't know though. See, because this is where it gets tricky, because I wear contacts. Mm-hmm. I would need two pairs. Here's where we get into it. I wear contacts most of the time. So if I'm going out, I'm in contacts. So I need just the sunglasses, right? But then on days where I'm just like working from home and whatever, and I just have to like run errands or I'm not really doing, it's glasses. So then I need the transitions so that it can go from like indoor to outdoor. I need two now, Tristan. I've theoretically bought two.
You might as well just go full, whole hog and get three. So
get all of them. But did you ever have Google Glasses?
I did not have Google Glass, and I don't know anyone that did. I met a guy that did.
Ugh.
But, you know, it's, I mean, they didn't have lenses built in. It was just basically a little frame. It had the lens in the corner where you could see something.
I know, but this was so many years ago. Like, think of where they would have been, but they just killed the project because it was way ahead of their time. I cannot talk about these smart glasses without saying, like, who paved the way for this? It was Google, man. They were way paved the way.
There's a
dude,
I think it was at the some guy I saw in the 90s who was used to walk around campus. It was at University of Ottawa. It was there's some university in the I think Eastern Canada, and he had a webpage and he was doing this PhD student, and he had this whole, he was like carrying a laptop on his hip, and then eventually the device got smaller and he had this big old headset, and he was maybe we'll dig that up and find some evidence about some of the early research in this whole domain. And the guy looked like a cyborg basically, but it had a lot of those components that got shrunken down over time. Of course, I don't think it had any of the AI features, but
one of the things
that's missing here is the heads up display. Like it has the audio feedback, but no heads up display. And maybe that's just a bridge too far. Like, but if you could project something on the inside or in the corner of one of the screens, like the Google Glass had in the top corner, it had that little lens, that little cube that you could see things with. But
it's coming.
I don't know. I think this form factor is the way it's going to go. And people are saying, well, where the hell is Apple's foray into this? But, you know, they're starting big with the Apple Vision Pro and their spatial computing and all that. And maybe they'll get there, start high and then go down market. So
scale it down.
Yeah, Meta's obviously got the lead here. But, I mean, it's still very early days.
Well, the question, too, is like, so they've had this, you should get one. We should get them and just test them out. But, like, it's great. It's got the multimodal AI, but is Meta's AI actually any good? Is the real question.
Well, some people are having mixed results with it. And it's funny, we have to have a whole episode on AI backlash at some point, because we've seen a number of different types of backlash. And this is just another thing. I think some people are anti-AI for whatever reason, but some people also just like don't like change. So we discussed last week Meta's AI assistant, their new model, Llama 3, been globally released, and it's been integrated by Meta into its platforms like Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, and Messenger, formerly known as Facebook Messenger. And the users are reporting problems such as the AI, fabricating life stories. We talked about the AI who said it had a kid last week. And the image generation flaws, of course, to be expected. But then some bots pretending to be humans, as mentioned. Some of the other complaints is that it's, the common complaints is the Meta AI is built into the search bar of the aforementioned platforms and cannot be turned off, which leads to user frustration. Now, what Meta said in response is like, well, you can bypass the AI by just using the search bar like you normally would and don't click the blue send icon, which activates AI chat. Just do your normal sort of searches. And, I think things populate automatically because this stuff will do everything that search bar will still do everything it did before. So you don't have to engage the AI.
Yes and no, because here's the frustration is they've designed it so it looks different now. So, and it functions different. So like even on Instagram now, on certain pages where you're scrolling, because they keep like updating Instagram and things keep breaking because of this, it like sits way lower on the top quarter of the screen now in Instagram, and it looks totally different. And honestly, it's jarring and it screws up with like your user interface. It's like, dude, I don't need to search right now. If I do, I'll access a search bar. I don't need to. I'm mindlessly scrolling. Like, so I do understand people's frustration, like, with it, for sure.
And hopefully they will continue to refine that. Literally, it's been less than a week. But that's not the only platform that's had encountered some user frustration. Snapchat, last summer, introduced their feature called My AI. And it was a generative AI chatbot to help engage users through messaging. So you could access my from the chat screen and interact with it to get assistance. You could do assistance with trivia, you could recommendations, and so on. It also integrated sponsored links into my AI's responses to monetize the feature. So I'm sure that's exactly what people were looking for. And it learns from your interactions to improve responses and allow you to provide feedback to developers for further refinement. But in the last, you know, sort of 9 months or so since it's been out, its functionality has been criticized for lacking helpful features and experiencing glitches. So, I mean, glitches are to be expected, but, you know, how many people were really like hoping for features like, oh, sponsored content in there, right? Like, there seems like they're putting the cart before the horse a little bit. Users, however, can manage their data and privacy settings, including deleting content shared with My AI and restricting its access to your stories. As with Meta AI, it seems that a vocal contingent of folks want it gone. But to make it go away, sort of, you can kind of make it mostly go away, you need a Snapchat Plus membership, which offers additional features and control. So it's kind of like, it's there, partly because it's a monetization feature for them. And if you want to get rid of it, well, you got to pay. So
it's like,
enjoy.
Don't name it My AI. As if like it's mine and I control it, like when you can't and you don't want users to control it.
Exactly. Despite all that, Snapchat, as of December 2023, has 7 million paid subscribers for the Snapchat Plus. So some people are enjoying it. So it's time for Tasia's Google.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Corner.
Yes, this is second only to my other favorite thing of our AI whoopsie doopsies is me talking about Google. So just a quick little note for you is that Google's Gemini 1.5 Pro can now hear. So the model can listen.
It's always listening.
Right. It can listen to uploaded audio files, and then it'll produce information from things like, say it listens into your earnings call or meeting or audio from videos without needing to refer to any written transcripts, which is great and super helpful. So Google also announced that it's going to make Gemini 1.5 Pro available to the public for the first time through its platform to build AI applications that we've talked about before, Vertex AI. And just so, because, you know, Google loves their naming conventions, just so everybody knows, this is like the middle weight kind of model in the Gemini family. But Google is claiming that it already surpasses the biggest and most powerful model of theirs, which is Gemini Ultra, in performance. I feel like every company, we always laugh at this, they all just claim this next update surpasses everything else, and
so
it might be
Ultra
true.
So what's Ultra 4
then? Yeah, I mean, exactly. Like,
they got to make that better now.
Exactly. Mega. Exactly. So Gemini 1.5 Pro can understand complicated instructions, and it eliminates the need to fine-tune models. So it's kind of just an exciting update, but yeah, exactly to your point. Like, every time there is an update with an LLM, what is the line we say that everybody puts in the press release? Now more powerful than, well, and it's like, oh boy, Of course, because it's updated. Then you're going to update the next one and the other model, and then that's going to be more fun. It's just a cycle, everybody. It's just
like
a cycle.
Apple would always say, this is our best Mac yet. It's like, oh, yeah, I hope so.
I hope so. Look, what are you going to say? You know what? It's not great, but we put it out anyway. It's all right. If you're not looking for the best.
So we have another teeny bit of Google News as well.
Yes. Yeah, so there's been a bit of confusion lately on how Google like trains its AI models and such. And there was some concern over the last few weeks that your Google Docs could possibly be used in training them. This is not the case. So I just want to break it down a little bit so everybody kind of understands. There's a couple different sharing options when it comes to Google Docs. The two we're probably most used to are you can share it with specific people, say like you add individual emails, or you can send it, like set your doc to share with anyone with a link. There's another sharing option for people at an enterprise level where you can share it like with just people in your company, but we don't really need to get into that. So there was some concern that if you set your doc to anyone with a link, that, you know, does this make it public and available to Google to crawl, basically like to train their AI? So a representative for Google confirmed to Business Insider that changing settings to anyone with a link does not mean the document is public and it would not be used for AI training. So in order to be publicly available, that doc would need to be posted on a website or shared on social media somehow. So basically,
and then crawled by their typical Google crawler that way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that really can't happen with a file that's just, say, emailed back and forth between two people. So like, say I do this all the time with like YouTube clients. I'm sharing something via Google Drive and I need to share a specific file with them. I have to set it so anyone with a link, because they might also share within their team for review purposes. So that's something private between our emails. So they aren't crawling that and it's not considered public. So if you send your friend a link over Gmail, all is good. Do not panic, as an example.
And as far as we know, Google's not training their Gemini model on your Gmail yet. Speaking of tiny updates, Microsoft launches its smallest AI model yet. So they introduced Phi 3 Mini. So that's Phi PHI. It's a compact AI model with 3.8 billion parameters, and it's available on Azure Hugging Face and Ollama, which are all platforms for running your various LLMs. It's part of a series including Phi 3 Small and Phi 3 Medium. All right, so we got that. We got Mini, Small, and Medium. Now, despite its smaller size, Phi 3 Mini outperforms the previous Phi 2 model and can deliver responses comparable to models 10 times its size. So it performs comparably to Meta's Llama 3 and OpenAI's GPT 3.5, so, you know, generation ago, in benchmarks, and excels in arithmetic reasoning. Now, unlike larger models like GPT-4, Phi 3 Mini is designed to be sustainable in the operational sense, but by extension, you know, also environmentally. So if less compute is required to run it, then it's going to have a smaller footprint for energy and carbon footprint and all that sort of stuff. But these models are also cost-effective for operators and users, designed to perform well on personal devices, and are easier to adapt for mass market use. And they're also suitable for corporate use with smaller internal data sets. We've talked in the past about using your language models and then grounding them in your corporate knowledge base, so to speak. This sort of approach should do just fine. It was trained on high quality educational information and synthetic data, aiming for quality over quantity. So we're seeing a trend now. We've talked about this a couple of times over the last few months about how large language models aren't necessarily the be-all and end-all. There's a certain space out there for smaller models, whether they are restricted to certain domains of expertise and can be really good at at queries regarding the said domains, or ones that are optimized for lower resource intensity and running on things like your local device, laptop, and ultimately things like smartphones. So Microsoft is not alone in pursuing these sorts of measures, these smaller specialized models. We've talked a lot about Apple hinting at big moves in the AI space. Well, earlier this month, Apple released yet another AI paper. It's like every month or two, there's another paper with another model that they're working on. They're all this whole constellation of areas that they're working on in AI. So this paper was about its multimodal Ferret UI LLM, which interprets phone user interfaces or UIs. It highlights the potential of automating smartphone navigation to ease user interaction, and its has applications in accessibility and app testing. So it's seen as a valuable tool for enhancing accessibility for people. You know, Apple's been big on accessibility for years and years now, so you can navigate in non-traditional ways, including your voice. And also, it's good for multi-step UI navigation, performing usability studies. Their findings are published on archive.org, and that's spelt not the web or the internet archive. This is, I don't know how you actually pronounce this. I think it's still pronounced archive. It's arxiv.org, which has all sorts of research papers on there. And it's another clue to their ongoing research efforts in AI, which much of which they've been publishing and sharing in an open source sort of way. But that is just sort of a lead in to some of the other stuff that they're working on. So they're optimizing for navigation on devices and operation on devices with their language models. Well, let you take us into, we don't trade in a lot of rumors here, but where there's smoke, there's fire. Mm-hmm. And iOS 18, Teja, is looking to be like a big AI-focused release for Apple, especially if the WWDC teasers are any indication.
Yeah, and the big rumor is that a lot of these features are going to run on device. We'll see. I don't know, but when it comes to mobile devices, iOS 18 is coming, and it's going to have a heavy focus on this new AI-powered capability. So according to Bloomberg's Apple insider Mark Gurman, Apple is looking to continue its privacy-focused ethos with its AI products too, at least where it can. So Gurman said in his newsletter, quote, "As the world awaits Apple's big AI unveiling on June 10th, it looks like the initial wave of features will work entirely on device. This means there's no cloud processing component to the company's large language model, the software that powers the new capabilities." So this is kind of a really bold statement. I mean, he's usually not out in left field with these things. So if...
pretty reliable.
Yeah. If Apple can indeed use the iPhone's processing power to handle its AI features, this would mean, like, theoretically, your data does not leave your phone, and there's no, like, throwing it up to the cloud to process. So, like, you know how when we talked about Video Boost on Pixel 8 Pro, and, like, that's a process that is so intensive, it happens off device. So you set your device to Video Boost, you take your video, and then it throws it up to the cloud for processing. That can take minutes to hours, depending on how long of the video you shot.
But it helps save the battery life on your phone,
yes,
for example.
Yes, exactly. So this is my big thing, is like, you know, even the newest of iPhones might struggle to handle some of these features. Like, can we all just take a moment and picture how much a battery is going to overheat? Like, trying to run this on device. So, and then you think of things like older devices. Well, are they just going to be out of luck altogether? Like, with these certain things, which... we could get into a whole thing of then when is an old device time to go to the graveyard, because if you want all these AI features, like, you have to get a device that actually can run it on device, assuming any of this is true. So the catch here is that Apple can really only commit to, like, their privacy standards for the products that they build, because, like, we know and we've talked about them being in talks with other companies like Google and OpenAI as an example. So basically, like, if they do end up partnering with these companies, well, what if those iOS features are powered by, like, the cloud computing infrastructure of those companies? So then, like, will our data still be, like, sent off? Do you know what I mean? Like, they can say it's on device, but will it actually be sent to one of those parties that they've partnered with? So...
and there's been some speculation that they would handle certain requests like that could be handled on device by the device, and anything that had to do with user data. So for example, if something to do with your contacts or your calendar, you would still be in the Apple ecosystem, whether it's on device or say, maybe in iCloud. But if you were asking questions more like general generative AI type stuff where that would normally be handled by a ChatGPT or the like, then that would go to the cloud. But then how do you parse that? Like, what if you're including personal information in a query, right? Like, so it's going to be tricky for them to navigate those waters. And there'll probably be all sorts of caveats and disclaimers and, you know, stuff like that. Don't say anything you wouldn't say in public, et cetera.
Exactly.
But if you want to be able to control the features of your device, instead of like navigating through all sorts of layers of, you know, to turn of navigation to turn on or off specific features, that could be really handy. But where does the on-device stuff stop and the cloud processing begin? So we'll see how they do that one, because they've been promoting their user privacy protection for so long. So they're going to be under very heavy scrutiny to make sure they don't mess it up.
And we'll find out if any of it's true, hopefully in June at WWDC, we get a few answers.
So one of the ways that they're looking to power stuff, and the other thing I've heard too, is that the models that we're talking about might need at least 8 gigabytes of RAM. And so older phones are going to have a problem. Older phones do have neural engines. There's going to be a new A-series processor for sure on the iPhone devices, and you know the M-series chips on the iPads and MacBooks and other Macs are having more and more like neural, you know, engine type capabilities as well. So you might be okay for a generation or two back, but obviously the newer devices are going to be finely tuned for these queries and for running the new model, AI models that they've been working on. And so there was more information that came out. They released a set of small AI language models, hinting at plans to, you know, that you've touched on here, to integrate AI into their iPhones. And so they have a series of efficient language models called OpenELM, which are designed to perform text-related tasks like email writing, and it's even smaller than the most lightweight AI models. They range from 270 million to 3 billion parameters, so much smaller numbers than we've been talking about previously, is optimized for running on devices like phones and laptops. They were trained on data sets totaling 1.8 trillion tokens, so lots in the training data set, and they feature, here it comes, a layer-wise scaling strategy for efficient parameter allocation. You catch that? That's all that's what does that mean in English, you might ask? Well, in short, this strategy allows the model to handle complex language tasks effectively by optimizing how its computational resources are used across the model's architecture, ensuring that each layer contributes maximally to the overall performance of the model. So in some tangential way, you could it's basically like fancy compression. So it's not entirely dissimilar from how compression works in various domains such as images, video, and audio, but in a much more sophisticated way. It's not simply optimizing based on, you know, the sounds or the, you know, the pixels, but it's optimizing based on what it knows about what parts of the model are best used to process parts of a query and generate a response. So for several months now, Apple has been working really hard on the lightweight models, lots of compression, and can run on mobile devices. So again, we'll see come June, and then ultimately come the fall when the new operating systems and devices get released. But Apple is un-Apple move, they've been emphasizing transparency by releasing the source code, model weights, and training materials for OpenELM. So they're aiming to support open research and address potential biases. That's something that we've touched on over the past number of months as well. And of course, Apple CEO Tim Cook hinted at upcoming generative AI features for Apple devices, though specifics are not yet shared. So like you said, Teja, WWDC in June, it's probably going to be all AI all the time, as they've been teasing. You excited?
Oh, sure. Very excited. It's like...
And then a month later, there'll be a new Pixel phone.
Yeah.
And we'll forget all about Apple.
Exactly.
So speaking of Apple, there's just a little bit we wanted to leave you with from, there's a video that I came across from Bertrand Serlet, who is a legendary computer scientist, and he's known for his contributions in the development of operating systems and for his expertise in artificial intelligence, particularly in the realm of neural networks and language models. So all the kind of stuff that we've been talking about. And he did a little YouTube video just kind of breaking things down for like, and it's called Why AI Works. And it's mostly talking about LLMs. We've been talking a lot about smaller language models, but in this, he's talking about LLMs in general. And some of the high-level points he brings up have to do with LLMs' effectiveness and explaining how they're effective or why they're effective, because they encapsulate a vast amount of knowledge and reasoning patterns from the internet, allowing them to handle complex questions involving facts and reasoning. He discusses the underlying mechanics, you know, transforming the digital inputs into outputs using mathematical functions, vectors, weights, and biases. He talks about the training and optimization to adjusting the parameters to minimize errors between predicted and actual outputs. He talks about this notion called the blessing of dimensionality, and he's saying as high dimension, so we live in a 3D world. Well, once you're talking about data, you can have more than three dimensions, and you start adding, you know, other relationships between data allows for more nuanced patterns to be modeled, avoiding oversimplification and enhancing the model's ability to generalize from training data. And then he gets into some of the applications and implications, talking about autoencoders and embeddings, which illustrate the advanced applications of neural networks, showing how they can compress and upscale data, encode semantic relationships, and optimize learning and data representation across various domains. So there's that word again, compression. So that is one of the magical things about large language models. Some people think, oh, they're just hoovering up all the contents of the internet and they're storing it, and then they're regurgitating when you ask for it. That's not how they work. They learn from them and then discard the information, but maintain the relationship between the tokens, all the bits of the words that they've ingested over time, and then develop a probabilistic model for output. And, you know, there will be similar sorts of mechanisms for image, video, and audio generation as well. It all gets quite heady, but if you're interested at all in, you know, one computer scientist's take on how all of this works, we'll have a link in the show notes from Bertrand Serlet. Oh, yeah, and he worked at Xerox PARC, the famous laboratory, which inspired folks from Apple, Microsoft, and others. He worked at Next, which was Steve Jobs' company after Apple, and he worked at Apple itself. So just a little bit of homework for you if you're interested in some further reading. I know you'll be right on that, Deja.
So what you're saying is he's smart. Learn from him.
And I'm pretty sure he didn't have just have an AI do it for him.
Well, thanks, Tristan. I think we did it again. Episode 35 in the bag.
Something
like that. Well, thank you all so much for listening to another episode of AI Named This Show. If you enjoyed it, please remember to give us a rating and review on your favorite podcast app. We'd very much appreciate it.
AI and goodbye.